If you're running a business right now, you're playing a game where the rules keep changing. Trade tensions, economic uncertainty, culture wars, the world is rapidly changing around us. And companies, especially independent and local businesses, are having to adapt faster than ever. That's why Mission Critical is evolving. We're diving deep with the founders, CEOs, and entrepreneurs who are navigating this chaos in real time. The ones making the tough calls, pushing through unpredictability, and proving that resilience isn't just a buzzword, it's a survival skill. How do you scale in an economy that feels like it's on shaky ground? What happens when US policy shifts send shockwaves through Canadian industries? And in a world where diversity, healthcare, and economic resilience are becoming battlegrounds, how do businesses double down instead of backing down? These are the real conversations that matter to business leaders right now. I'm Lance Chung, and this is Mission Critical. Let's get into it. Thank you everyone for joining us this evening. We're so excited to welcome you into Holt Renfrew for another wonderful live taping of our podcast, Mission Critical. Ben, maybe you can just turn up the volume a little bit. And we're so excited to welcome today's guest as well, Young Wu, who is the former CEO of Mars Discovery District and the co-founder of the Coalition of Innovation Leaders Advancing Respect, or CLAR. He's also arguably one of Canada's most respected business leaders, so we're very lucky to have him share his energy and his time and his insights today. Young, thank you so much for being here. It's been a minute since we last chatted with each other, but I'm always so grateful to spend time with you. How are you?
I am really, really great. But I just wanted to say a little bit of something as well. It has been more than a minute, actually, Lance. You were my first interview when I joined Mars out of my second retirement at the time,
right,
back in 2017. And what I discovered about you and Glory Media and your team was an incredible curiosity to uncover and unpack not just the first layer, not just the second layer, but to really tell the stories behind the stories behind the stories. I've had an enormous amount of respect for the work you've done. So when you called me a day and a half ago, as I was driving back from one of my portfolio companies and said, Young, can you show up? It's a day and a half from now. I said, I can't turn you down on anything. And I think today, particularly today, in a day where maybe there's some challenges in terms of free speech and journalism, and where does the truth lie anyway? It's particularly important to respect organizations and leaders like Lance and his team who really do get at the story behind the story behind the story. Otherwise, I don't know what we're doing. We're just following someone else's, you know, with all due respect to the marketing people in the crowd, we don't just follow stories. I think we got to follow where the truth leads us. So I just wanted to tell you that, Lance. I'm here because of you, and it's been more than a minute.
Thank you so much. I really, really appreciate that. We're also here at Holt Renfrew, obviously a place that is known for style. So I thought we'd start by talking about your style of leadership. How would you describe it, and how has it evolved over the course of your career? Because you've seen many different offices and people and jobs, and you worked with many different leaders. So how would you say your style of leadership has evolved to where it is today?
I remember starting off my career as an entrepreneur, survived the first business, and then became a serial entrepreneur, survived a few more businesses, and became a compulsive entrepreneur. Never ever wanted to be a CEO, just kind of backed into that. But so many of my lessons from being an entrepreneur translated into being a CEO, which then translated into, I think, you know, leading global institutions and businesses. There's some really common threads. But I was just explaining to Dave that, you know, it's really interesting. You can get everything right. You can get strategy right. You can get customers right. You can even get talent right, that rich talent that basically drives everything. You can get processes right. It's all just table stakes, actually. It's table stakes. Because the things you don't control are the things that basically come to basically kill you or advance you.
And so I've discovered over time that whether one is a entrepreneur leading a group of seven people or a CEO leading a group of, you know, a couple of hundred people to a global, you know, sort of leader with a couple of thousand people, it's all the same, just differences and zeros. The trick is, how do you stay in the game long enough so that you control what end of the spectrum you finish in? Because success and failure are simply two different points on exactly the same continuum. And when you get everything right that you control, it just means that you're still in the game. So I have a, I think, can I say this, the name of the venture platform? Okay. So my venture platform is called NFQ Ventures. And you can fill in what it stands for. I'll give you a hint. It stands for never and quit. You've got to fill in the F for yourself. It's because I just don't believe that it should be easy to quit. And so fail fast to me is a little too close to quit fast. You should learn fast, adapt fast, be extremely agile, particularly today when the cycle time of what happens is so unbelievably quick. But it just should be hard to quit fast, because when you quit fast, you miss that opportunity. And I don't care whether it's a startup or a scale-up or an institution. Mars was a organization that, as you might recall, at some point had a building that was half in progress that at some point, I think 2017 to 2023 is when I was CEO there, we had to run through the pandemic, we had to run through government changes, we had all kinds of things happening, but it was sort of like, how do you stay agile and adaptable through a business that essentially held, you know, a couple of billion dollars worth of real estate, had a couple of hundred people, were supporting, you know, 1,200 companies with, at the time I left, it was about 30,000, 32,500 people in the ecosystem. Like, how do you do that? It's agility and adaptability. It was never about sort of being able to predict the perfect pathway and get everything right. It was just being able to react, read the signals, call the audibles, and stay in the game long enough. And, you know, if you're interested, I'll tell you all about sort of the outcomes of the whole thing.
But yeah, anyway. Yeah. I mean, you've had an incredible, incredible career and developed so many amazing insights. You know, from your vantage point, you've also been able to work with so many incredible leaders that are also CEOs and founders of their own companies. How do you think that the expectation of those leaders has changed over the past, let's say, 10 years? Because a lot has happened in the last 10 years. A lot happens in the span of a week these days. But overall, from your perspective, how would you say our expectation of leadership has changed in that kind of timeline?
Well, I define leadership at its most simplest level as being able to create followership. And it's always easy when things are going great. The past 10 years, for many of the past 10 years, you know, capital was free. Interest rates were very low. That's what created a lot of the froth. And so when things are going great and, you know, you got everything going with a lot of tailwinds and anything you do is just like continuing to lift, it creates a bit of a false sense of, I think, confidence for first-time entrepreneurs. And everybody is your friend. Everybody is, you know, your ally. They're all there cheering you on the sidelines. When things get tough is when you actually find out two things: who's really got your back, and it's I'm going to say it is a minuscule portion of those that were apparently on your boat when things were all going great. But it's also when you create the most value. Because if you can have the resilience and the endurance to stay in the game, to NFQ yourself through to the spectrum which says success and not failure, that's when you get remarkable companies. I mean, I have a bit of a rhetorical question for you, which is, what is common between Microsoft, Salesforce, Airbnb, GE, some of the greatest companies in the world? They were all founded and built in times of challenge. They found new ways and different ways and learned different ways. You know, today in the age of AI and in the age of sort of this digital environment, it's not about being a know-it-all, it's about being a learn-it-all. And when you can take those lessons away from what you're experiencing and apply them in a thoughtful, multi-level way, you actually build resilience, and that resilience is what carries you through the hard times and gets you through to the bigger successes. My first company was started on three of my credit cards, Amex, MasterCard, and Visa. I still have them right here in my pocket. $10,000 per credit card, $30,000 back in 1990. And we eventually sold that company for $1 billion to Oracle. So that's a nice story, but it's just a story. That wasn't the real story. Those are just two different bookends, and in between those bookends was surviving the tech bust. Growing that company from three credit cards to 400 plus people, and then taking down 400 people to 30 in order to get through the worst of times. Rebuilding that through Tyco, Enron, AIG, Sarbanes-Oxley, selling that company about 3 weeks before. So Charles Phillips bought that company for $1 billion 3 weeks before the meltdown of Lehman Brothers. It wasn't the story of three credit cards to $1 billion. It was a question of survival, even with everything else going right. And by the way, sometimes I think to myself, what if it was Lehman Sisters and not Lehman Brothers? Maybe I would have gotten $2 billion instead of one. But anyway, that's a story for another day.
Yeah. Incredible, incredible. In our audience today, we've got a mix of entrepreneurs, founders, various business leaders. What advice would you give them about building that level of, or that sense of resilience and relevance in today's climate, where every day can really feel like there's a new sense of chaos that's happening, volatility? What's your best advice, having been through the fire, the storms, what's your best advice on cultivating a sense of resilience?
Well, maybe I can put my answer in a bit of context. So the context is, I think Donald Trump is now being in office for his return to office for about 248 days. At least that's what I think I remember from this morning's. Yeah, so he's about two-thirds of his way through his return to office. And in the context of all of the drama and all of the turmoil that it has created for Canada, I think it is imperative for Canada to build from strength right now. We are not weak because Donald Trump made us weak. We are weak because we have underinvested into our own productive capacity, into our own value chain, into our own entrepreneurs and value creators. And that's why, you know, when Lance asked me to show up here, you know, a day and a half ago, of course I said yes because Lance was the one that asked, but also because I knew who would be in the room today. You're the people that Canada needs to build around. And quite honestly, we have an atrociously low risk appetite here. We're probably the richest country in the world by way of resources and by the way of, you know, opportunities. And we used to have the biggest market in the world be our best friend. It'll happen again. But during that time, during those decades, what have we done? We've used the US as a crutch, not necessarily as a launch pad. And we have not invested into our own capacity. I think the last stats I saw from Statistics Canada said that Canada is on its way to being 38 in the OECD. From a productivity point of view, productivity growth point of view, by 2030. There's 38 countries only in the OECD. We're headed towards dead last. And Matt, where are you? From the Board of Trade. I just recently retired from the Board of Trade. Matt always hammers this into me.
There he is. Over there at the back there.
Okay.
Yeah.
He's hiding at the back. So Matt always tells me, you know what? Dead last is dead wrong. We have an opportunity to turn this around by investing into our own productive capacity. And each of you who are leaders in this room have the opportunity to be the anchor for Canada to build strength. I mean, literally, I'm halfway through my thank you letters to Donald Trump, which I'm going to finish writing because he's been the catalyst for us to actually look at how do we actually create value and keep value here in Canada. I probably won't send them, but you know what? If he's the catalyst for this crisis, then great. Anyway, it's a long-winded way to get at the context for your question. Now, what was your question again? I've forgotten now.
How do you cultivate a sense of resilience, and what's your best advice for people to do so?
Right. I got a couple of lessons that I could probably draw upon. The innovation ecosystem today, if you think about not just the startups, but also the companies, large incumbent companies in Canada that invest into technology and innovation, do you know how much of a percentage of GDP that drives? 12%. 12% means it's bigger in aggregate than oil and gas, than lumber, than mining. Because I'm picking off the investments made by oil and gas, lumber, and mining into innovation and technology as part of this aggregate group. Guess what else? It's growing at 3 to 6 times the rate of any other sector. So where can Canada find resilience from? I think it's about backing the innovation community and backing the adoption of innovation. The AI supercycle itself is probably the most important supercycle since the Industrial Revolution. There's no company that, if they're not on the track of how to basically adopt AI, there's a threat within the next 18 to 24 months that you're going to be the old joke about sort of when you're trying to outrun the bear. It's not important that you outrun the bear. It's more important that you outrun the other people running from the bear. Yeah. So this is the trick. One source of resilience, one source of is being on the track that actually drives national priority, national prosperity. Another thing maybe I'd like to share is that, you know, talent in the innovation economy. Talent fuels the innovation economy. It is everything. And so how do you go about nurturing that talent and unlocking the value of that talent is a big, big, big topic. And maybe we'll talk about this a bit later on, because I think it completely relates to how do you, I mean, I'm an immigrant here. I was lucky enough to come to Canada to escape a military autocracy. I didn't speak English or French at the time. Maybe I still don't speak English that well, but you know, I learned my way through this. But what I got out of that experience was I understood how special this place was. And I also know what life looks like when you don't have all the privileges that we have here in Canada. People like me, or people that are under sponsored, didn't come from the right schools, perhaps didn't come from the right socioeconomic classes, perhaps didn't come from, you know, so people like me have something that I call the edge, which is when you have nothing to lose and you've got everything to gain, you don't waste a single piece of that. I believe that if we can unlock talent that is driven by that, by the way, entrepreneurs and immigrants are very, very similar in this way. When you got nothing to lose and everything to gain, you can 10x whatever you take on. So how do you drive the right talent and devote them to an innovation economy that's growing 3 to 6 times the rate of any other sector? And how do you therefore then build on that to build resilience and prosperity for Canada that translates into this place being the multi-generational destination for the talent, the capital, and the investment that follows from that to build industries that are based here, not just industries that leave here?
Yeah, yeah. I want to also shift to kind of your journey to where you are right now as an accumulation of all the experiences you've had. You know, after a remarkable career at Mars and, you know, building your other companies, what motivated you to co-found with your co-founders, CLAR, which is the Coalition of Innovation Leaders Advancing Respect? Can you tell us a little bit more about it as well?
Sure. Well, I mean, it's probably a linked topic to what we were just chatting about. To me, this group is a group with members including Google, including Salesforce, JP Morgan, Omers,
TD Bank. They're the biggest of the biggest, and they've also got a focus on the innovation economy. So shock and surprise, it's still about the innovation economy. But the point is, as a group, we've determined that one of the best things we can do is to ensure that we create the talent base that can fuel businesses that drive down this path of disruption and transformation. And so our first big initiative is called AI Powered Futures. We are in business to try and upskill 100,000 Canadians. Although recently at our launch event, I think we were challenged to do 1 million instead of 100,000. By the way, translate that. That's $15 billion of GDP per year. Mm-hmm. When you add these things up, perhaps Donald Trump, back to that theme and that topic, with a 25% tariff across the board, remember that back in February and in March, that would have resulted, according to most of the economists, about a 2.6% hit on our GDP, let's say $50 to $80 billion. We can find areas where we invest into the future through investing into leaders and entrepreneurs and innovators like yourselves to create $1 trillion of value. I like our odds if we can do that. But if we float back into, low risk appetite, follow, not lead, if we don't play business like we play our hockey, then we deserve our own outcomes.
Mm-hmm. I want to just also kind of go to the mission statement of CLR. Equip 100,000 future-ready Canadians with AI and digital skills by 2030, especially from underrepresented communities. Why was that the right mission for all of you at the organization at that time? Why was that kind of the through line for everything that you, all the decisions and choices that you would make from there on?
Well, the focus was on how do we create pathways to provide a hand up, not a handout, to under-sponsored communities. So the pathway into the innovation economy was clearly an opportunity for us to focus on, and that's why we developed this particular mission. Upskilling 100,000 Canadians essentially forms the feedstock of talent that small, medium-sized businesses need in order to drive competitiveness globally. And it also provides pathways for under-sponsored members of the community to drive prosperity in their communities. So I think this is all about respect, and I think this is all about inclusion. And you know how Einstein has this equation, E equals MC squared. So we have a little equation in CLAR, the Coalition of Innovation Leaders Advancing Respect. And it's prosperity is equal to performance to the power of inclusion. We think that inclusion basically gives you a multiplier effect on performance, multiplied by productivity to the power of innovation. So break down that equation, and if you parse it down, you'll see what the whole hypothesis of CLAR is all about. How do you drive prosperity? By including people and respecting that they can bring their NFQ, nothing to lose, everything to gain kind of mentality in order to drive performance. Very similar to sports, very similar to entrepreneurism, very similar to immigrants. And you light up productivity with innovation. I can take that equation and I can bring it to RBC, or I can bring it to a startup, or I can bring it to a community. And I know that we would get a 10x on what we're currently doing right now. And this is the time. This is the time that we need the 10x, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. I also want to say, you've had 270 executives in reciprocal mentoring, $400,000 invested in Black-led businesses, 450 mentoring opportunities created for BIPOC youth. Is there a particular milestone that you are most proud of personally?
I think we are now 5 years old as an organization, and those were great programs that we still continue. One of the things I've learned, again, in terms of institutions, organizations, associations, or startups, is that things go through stages. So I'm incredibly proud of all the things you mentioned, Lance, for the first 5 years, 2020 to 2025. I think 2025 to 2030 has to be about driving scale, not just interesting programs.
And so when we think about raising the stakes from 500 entrepreneurs to 100,000 Canadians, it's to drive scale. I'm part of the mayor's economic action team, stands for MEAT, which is kind of the answer to where's the beef, if you think. But one of the initiatives we're driving there is how do we unlock prosperity for the city of Toronto, which is the fastest growing innovation urban center in North America right now. And that means that we have to basically equip the talent base for the businesses here to drive the prosperity engine for the community. And so that's why, you know, I think the story of CELAR has yet to be told. There were great things done in the startup phase. We have to do things at scale in the scale phase. And so these are the chapters that we go through.
Best is yet to come.
Best is yet to come, thank you.
Yeah. You know, for a lot of the business leaders here, what role do you think the private sector companies can play in building more inclusive prosperity through the vehicle of innovation?
Well, I would just say, first of all, that inclusion is not a charity item. It is not a check mark. It isn't something just where, you know, you're doing something to look good. It's not performative. It is actually competitive. So the first thing is private sector businesses that want to be competitive in the age of AI and in the age of sort of a global geoeconomic, geopolitical, and geosocial turmoil. If you do not invest into unlocking the talent and providing these kinds of pathways, you do so at your own risk, actually, because it's not charity. It's survival. And it's actually winning. So I think that's the one thing I would point out to private sector businesses. We, again, live in a day where, you know, we got things being thrown around like, is it woke or isn't it woke? Or, you know, you got all kinds of stories about DE&I. This is not about entitlement. This is about earning competitiveness. And when you as a business or a leader understand the value of your team and you respect them and you give them the tools to actually operate, the women, the Black, Indigenous, people of color, different socioeconomic brackets, different, you know, didn't go to the right school types, and you unlock that, I guarantee you, I've seen it happen, you're gonna 10x that. My first company, that credit card company, back then we had a quota, and it's not what you think. My quota was, I want to make sure that one out of every five as a bare minimum people that we hired came from the East Coast. Pretty simple. We 10x the company because of the value systems and the cultural systems and the communities and the education and the value and the work ethic. We 10x our company based on that and that alone. In fact, we actually said Hibernia has all the people we ever wanted to hire, or we can make them a customer. We said, we'll never make them a customer. We're just going to go and take their people, which is what we did. And it was an amazing boost for the company. Talent fuels the companies. And it's still the case today. So I'd say focus on your talent, unlock the value of the talent, invest into your team, give them the tools they need to compete and to win. And by the way, you're going to do something really good as well by driving inclusion because your community wants it as well.
Yeah.
Why not?
Just as we kind of round out for our last few questions here, I wanted to also circle back to our conversation or some of the notes you talked about with regards to AI. You know, it's often talked about in terms of through the lens of fear and anxiety. And in many cases, that can be valid. But, you know, when it comes to jobs that may be lost or automation disruption, but how do you think that what do you think about the power of AI for good and through, you know, the work that you guys are doing at CELAR and harnessing AI to create more opportunity as well?
Well, I mean, I know there's always been a fear in large organizations, even small organizations that haven't been able to invest into innovation and technology and AI in particular. You know, is it going to cost me my job if I actually admit that I use ChatGPT, you know, in the office? You know, they say that oncologists aren't going to be replaced by AI. It's oncologists who use AI that'll replace oncologists who do not use AI. Why? Because this is actually a time for learn-it-alls. It's an unbelievable time. Of course we have to govern this properly. Of course we have to make sure there's security and privacy and, you know, rails in place to protect ourselves. But this genie's out of the bottle. Either you're running the race against your peers or you're being caught by the bear, you're bear food. So I don't think this is a question of do I or don't I. The rest of the world is doing this already. You have to be competitive. And here's the thing, this is not technology for technology's sake. This is technology applied to life sciences, to financial services, to real estate. There's not a sector in existence today that doesn't have some transformative or disruptive challenge or opportunity ahead of it because of the use of AI. So get in the race, lace up. You gotta outrun the other people. You don't have to outrun the bear.
That's a fantastic way to kind of wrap up. Just, you know, for the leaders in the room here, what would you say is one thing they can do tomorrow to lead with more impact and respect outside of not being bear food?
Leaders have an unbelievable position to not just duck when the bullets are flying. You have a chance to actually convert on challenge into your voices are important. Your companies are important. Your voices are important. And what you do is being watched by your staff, by your customers, by your partners. And this is a time when, you know, the call is here because Canada actually needs you to be successful. Your governments need you to be successful. Your communities need you to be successful. So this is the time, I think, if you want to turn on the jets. There's an enormous amount, probably the first time I've seen in all my time here since I emigrated to Canada, where I've seen such collective intention such unity from coast to coast to coast. So this is the time to turn on the jets, and to do good is not necessarily something where you're giving away charity. Doing good for your community, I think, does great things for your brand and for your companies. And I think it results in network effect. It does result in multiplication. You know, my grandmother used to tell me, don't make 1 + 1 = 2. Make it equal 11, because this is the time for this to happen. So much of the headwinds can actually be tailwinds when you actually position this properly and run after it.
I love that. I always feel a renewed sense of optimism whenever I talk to you. So thank you so much for your insight and your perspective. A big round of applause for you. That's a wrap on this episode of Mission Critical. If today's conversation gave you something to think about, do me a favor. Subscribe, leave a review, and share it with someone who needs to hear it. Big ideas are meant to be shared, and the best insights only matter if they're put into action. Until next time, stay sharp, stay curious, and go and make something happen. I'm Lance Chung, and this is Mission Critical.